Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, November 30th, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call, which will provide an update on the topic of joint employment. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today we welcome our expert, Ronald Meisberg, who is a former NLRB member and general counsel, and is currently special counsel at Hunton and Williams. Today I will turn it over to Ronald to get us started. Following opening remarks, we will open the floor for audience questions, so please do be thinking about your questions. Thank you for speaking with us. Ronald, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Nate, and good afternoon, everyone. Today I want to talk about the joint employer doctrine under the National Labor Relations Act, what it is, what its legal implications are, how we got to where we are today, and sort of most interestingly, especially after the election, what's likely to happen going forward, and then leave time for some Q&A. Joint employer has been used a long time under the National Labor Relations Act, over 50 years, to determine when two employers ought to be treated as responsible for a group of employees under the Act. It's premised on the common control exercised by one company over the employees of another company. A joint employer finding can be made under the traditional test, where two separate companies co-determine the terms and conditions of employment. That means things like wages, hours, benefits, et cetera, for the employees of one of the two companies, or where one of the two companies exercises control of the employees of the other company and thereby determines, again, their terms and conditions of employment. And the finding of being a joint employer essentially is the same as making you an employer under the National Labor Relations Act. And it has, you know, substantial impacts. An employer can't discriminate against or coerce or intimidate any employees of the other company who exercise protected rights, including the right to form a union. The joint employer must bargain along with the other company for the with the union that represents that other company's employees when they're joint employers. The joint employer must sign any agreement reached in bargaining. Failing to do these things would require the joint employer to provide a make-whole remedy for any unfair labor practices for which it's found responsible. So there are substantial legal duties that flow from being found to be a joint employer of another company's employees. Now, the roots of the joint employer test go way back under the law to cases decided by the original NLRB, which culminated in a decision of the Supreme Court in 1944 in the case of NLRB versus Hearst Publications. And in that case, the Supreme Court concluded that the Act's definition of employee should include independent contractors, and in this case, news delivery personnel who delivered Hearst Publications. And the court, you know, based its holding that independent contractors could be included by saying that anyone having an economic relationship with a company could be deemed to be its employee, and that the employee relationship should be determined based on economic facts rather than technically and exclusively by previously established legal classifications. What that means is that the economic relationship of the worker and the company to determine whether there's an employer relationship should be determined not by traditional common law master-servant or agency principles, which had been traditionally used by courts, but instead by economic facts, economic realities. the Congress responded to the Supreme Court 3 years later when it enacted the Taft-Hartley amendments to the National Labor Relations Act, and they expressly excluded independent contractors from the definition of employee. And in the legislative history, they explained why they did this. It was because they wanted to limit the employer-employee concept to instances where the putative employer exercised some direct control over the putative employees, and they rejected, you know, the expansive and policy-based notions like economic realities in favor of the principles of common law agency. And that's been the law that has been applied by the board up to this past 2015, this past year before. Now, the Supreme Court's formulation was not Congress's formulation was not without support in plenty of case law, but going back well over 100 years, in a case called Schenker versus Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Company, the Supreme Court had decided that under the common law, immediate control and supervision is critical in determining the employer for whom the servants are performing services. So this notion of direct and immediate control of exercised authority is key to how the courts and the board have looked at whether someone would be deemed a joint employer in the last 70 some odd years under the board. So the lessons to be drawn from where we were are pretty straightforward. The board must use a traditional common law principles when deciding who is an employer or a joint employer. Those principles have been understood as requiring more than mere indirect or reserved but unexercised control. And those principles are not based on economic realities. Instead, they are based on exercised, direct, and immediate control of terms and conditions of employment. Now, the Browning-Ferris case that was decided by the board in August of 2015, one of the biggest changes in the history of the board in terms of its doctrine came along and very significantly changed the joint employer standard. I'll have to apologize if you can hear the sirens. They're not coming for me, but we're next to the George Washington Hospital here, so you have to bear with me. The board in Browning-Ferris said they're not going to require any longer that the employer exercise authority, nor will they require that the control be exercised when it was exercised directly and immediately. Instead, it would be enough that the employer possess the authority to control the employees of another employer, or if it did so indirectly. In other words, a company's retention of an unexercised right to control another company's employees or indirectly doing so are now potentially dispositive of the joint employer status. And the lead case before the NLRB, the BFI, Browning-Ferris Industries case, provides a good example of this new expanded test. Browning-Ferris operated a recycling facility, and in that recycling facility, they had a conveyor belt in which they would run down various items to be recycled, and from that conveyor belt, workers would take various items and put them in various bins in order to separate out different types of recyclable items. And in running this facility, they brought in a contractor, a company called Leadpoint, to provide some of the workers to work on the conveyor belt. Now, the union filed a petition for an NLRB election to represent Leadpoint's employees. And when they filed the petition, they named Leadpoint as an employer, but they also named Browning-Ferris as the joint employer. As I said before, this could mean Browning-Ferris would have an obligation to bargain with the union, to sign the contract reached in bargaining, to comply with that contract, to remedy unfair labor practices, all the things that go along with being an employer. And give you two examples of how the board employed its new test. One of the indicia of joint employer status, according to the board, was that Browning Ferris retained the power to reject or discontinue use of any lead point employee. It didn't require that it have exercised that power, just required that it retained the power. Now, I suspect in most contracts where there are individuals being supplied by another employer to perform work on an employer's property, contain some kind of similar provision that allows the user employer to get rid of employees who come in and commit major safety violations or some other major breach of a policy. They have it in there for their own protection and protection of the other employees on the property. But in this case, they had it, but they never exercised it. But nevertheless, just because they had it, the board said this was an indicator of joint employer status. Similarly, BFI indicated indirect control over the lead point employees, according to the board, because they had a provision in their contract with lead point that said that lead point couldn't pay its workers on the assembly line, the conveyor belt, any more than the Browning Ferris employees on the conveyor belt were making. Well, that's understandable, and I've seen that kind of provision in other contracts, and you can understand the reason for it. It'd be a pretty undermining of morale if you found out that the contractor employees who were brought in were making the same as the employees of the company, and Browning Ferris didn't want that problem. Now, the board said, well, that indirectly controls the wages of the lead point employee. So those were the types of things the board relied upon to find joint employer. And so this new test leads to the obvious question that if a putative joint employer never actually exercises direct control over the employees of another company, how much retained or indirect control will be sufficient to establish joint employer status? Sort of a how high is up kind of question. Well, according to the board, this is going to be determined on a case-by-case basis. So the murky guidance provided by the board in the Browning Ferris opinion and the determination on these cases on a case-to-case basis, this issue on a case-to-case basis, makes it virtually impossible to give, at least at this point, a definitive answer to the question of how much retained or indirect control will amount to joint employer status. Now, as you can imagine, this has led to the creation of tremendous legal uncertainty and the possible imposition of legal and economic burdens not anticipated by the parties when they entered into their contracts. These cases not only can have a very serious result if there's a finding of joint employer upheld, but they can be very expensive to try. I'm sure many of you have heard of the case that the NLRB General Counsel now is trying against McDonald's Corporation, involving 29 of McDonald's franchisees and McDonald's Corporation, saying that they are a joint employer and trying to hold McDonald's responsible for alleged unfair labor practices committed by the franchisees. This case has been going on for quite a while, for over a year now. They've currently had well over 50 days of trial, nearly 30 witnesses, over 1,500 exhibits. Trial dates are scheduled through the end of next month and further out. And McDonald's at one point said that they had spent just for the investigative subpoena that the NLRB issued, over $1 million just on consultants, people who'd come in and help produce the paper that the NLRB had subpoenaed. These are also very expensive for the general counsel to try. I know when I was general counsel, we tried a very big case against CNN under the old standard, not under the new standard. And in that case, I think we had the second biggest record ever in a board case. And we actually had to reprogram some of our appropriations in order to have enough money to pay for the trying of that case. So the GC, the current GC, has issued a cost-cutting memorandum earlier in the year, and I suspect driven in part by the tremendous expense of trying the McDonald's case and some other cases, so that this is not a small litigation, at least at this point. These are very large litigations. Now, who's at risk under this new test? Well, in addition to franchisors and franchisees and temporary staffing agencies like LeadPoint and their end user, BFI, service providers and service users, particularly where the services are provided on site, that could be like janitorial services, guard services, general contractors and subcontractors, maybe even private equity and portfolio companies, maybe joint venture partners and a joint venture entity. There's no limiting principle as to why any of those couldn't be found to be joint employers under the board's new test. So there's a very wide net that can be thrown out and ensnare many kinds of business relationships in our economy. Now, as I said, this Browning-Ferris decision, the change in the standard for joint employer, is one of the biggest changes in labor law made by the Obama NLRB. And up until very recently, it looked as if it was going to be a long slog in order to try and overcome it with litigation, not a political fix, as the only option. But now the election of President-elect Trump has very likely changed that. But the key will be gaining political control of the NLRB. The most likely, the NLRB itself, once the Republicans have gained control of it, will be the entity that can put an end to this madness and overrule the Browning-Ferris test. Court cases and pending administrative litigation will be dealt with in due course, and I suppose there's the possibility of legislation down the line, but the National Labor Relations Act has proved to be notoriously difficult to amend because of the contentiousness between labor and management reflected in the breakdown of Democrat and Republican positions on the Hill. Just to give you a little bit of background on the labor board for those of you who don't practice before it, the labor board consists of two internal entities that are separate from one another. The National Labor Relations Board itself has five members, and it's an adjudicatory board. It decides cases. They also have a general counsel who's independent, and he investigates and prosecutes cases that eventually can become before the board. Now, gaining political control of the board will not start with the general counsel. It will start with the board, and here's why. The board currently has one Republican and two Democrat members and two vacancies. So this gives the new president the ability to name Republicans to the board and gain political control as soon as they can identify candidates for those jobs. Now, the vetting process of those who've been through it is it can be quite arduous for the person who's being vetted. And the transition team itself has, of course, as you can see from following the news, has a lot on its plate right now. So part of the timing on this as to how soon they can get people into these two board seats is partly on how big a priority is this to the new administration, and will they be able to identify candidates readily available to who can be easily vetted and qualified to appoint. And probably the earliest they could get control of the board would be during a recess around President's Day. That's at least what I'm told. As you know, the Noel Canning case, which was decided by the Supreme Court last year, decided that the board, that the president's recess appointment power needed recesses of 10 days at least, and which had been the custom. And so, of course, the Republican-controlled Senate and House can give the president that kind of a window if he needs one. So if they get people identified and vetted and ready to go, they could, as soon as then, I think, put their members on the board. Otherwise, there'll just be a time lag while the individuals, if they don't recess anybody, go through the vetting process and then through the Senate confirmation process. And it's, again, unclear how much time that would take. But once the Republicans do take control of the board, if they want to address, which I think they will want to address this, how will they do it? Well, the board will need to identify a case, a vehicle, which presents the joint employer issue, and that could come up in a case that's been decided already where somebody's been deemed to be a joint employer and they've appealed to the board. So they may have a they may have some cases at the board now that present this issue that they could turn to relatively quickly. One of the things they're going to have to deal with is the BFI case, though, which is pending in the D.C. Circuit. Now, the D.C. Circuit, it could decide that case either way. I'm sure that the current board, that the new board, would prefer that it not have the opportunity to decide the case, if possible, simply to avoid the risk of an adverse decision. The case is fully briefed before the D.C. Circuit. Oral argument has not yet been scheduled, I don't think. It seems to me that, you know, if the board has a vehicle before it where it can announce that it's going to revisit this joint employer test and that it's going to take amicus briefs, which has been basically the way the Obama board has worked fairly effectively, and then go to the D.C. Circuit and ask that the case be held in abeyance on the basis that the board's actively reconsidering its position. Seems to me that's, if that's done before oral argument, there's a fairly decent chance the board might, the D.C. Circuit might grant that. Once the oral argument's taken place and the case is submitted, I'm not enough of an appellate advocate expert to know what the chances are after that. But obviously, you can see the timing on all this will be very, very important. Now, the McDonald's case and the other cases that are being prosecuted by the general counsel are a different story. The general counsel's term doesn't end until November of 17, assuming he doesn't resign. And I know I was a holdover Republican appointee into the first 18 months of the Obama administration, and so I can sort of sympathize from the other side with what the current general counsel, Dick Griffin, is going through, because he's got a board up there that he knows is not going to be sympathetic to many of his, not all, but certainly some of the positions he's taking. In the McDonald's case, the board really doesn't have the ability to sort of stop that case, except to the extent they take some interlocutory appeal on a procedural issue and maybe gain some leverage there. But otherwise, the general counsel has unreviewable prosecutorial discretion. It's his case, and he can continue to prosecute it. Whether he will, you know, based on the sure knowledge that it's going to have a probably unfavorable reception when and if it gets to the board, is another question, and that's something he'll have to decide. So that's kind of where things are at the board. I'll just very briefly mention that this is not an issue confined to the board. The Department of Labor Wage and Hour Administrator has said that the joint employer joint employment should be regularly considered in FLSA and Migrant and Seasonal Agricultural Worker Protection Act cases. The Solicitor's Office has said that OSHA would intend to apply a standard which included unexercised potential control of working conditions and economic realities, very similar to what the board said there, based theirs on. The EEOC filed an amicus brief in the Browning-Ferris case in the D.C. Circuit and said that they use the same joint employment standards. So even if the board is able to overrule the current test, the standard as applied by the Department of Labor and other agencies will have to go through its own process to the extent they have and desire to change the standards as it's currently applied. So that's sort of the history of joint employment, where it is now, what we kind of think might be happening next, and I'd be happy at this point to entertain any questions that you may have.
Okay, Ronald, thank you very much for that. I will now open the floor for questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Before we get to questions, I just want to make one programming announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow afternoon, December 1st at 2 p.m. That call will discuss the siege of Aleppo and war crimes. The call will feature Professor Lori Blank from Emory Law School, and we'll also have with us Professor Michael Newton from Vanderbilt University Law School. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign. Ronald, it doesn't look like we have any questions at this time from the audience. Is there?
Well, it's very gratifying to give a presentation that answers everybody's questions.
Well, I think you've done that, and you've done that well. Are there any additional remarks you'd like to give us in conclusion?
Well, no, I think this is the joint employer issue that the board, the new test it created, is probably along with micro units and the ambush elections, which is how the kind of popularly named for the doctrines they've created for how they're going to find bargaining units and the rules they promulgated to conduct elections. These are probably the largest issues out there. There are a number of other ones, but I would say the full board, the new board, will have its plate full. And if you want a bit of a roadmap as to what's likely to happen in the next 4 years, you can look at the dissents by Member Miscamira, Member Johnson, and Member Hayes over the last 5 years. They'll give you a pretty good roadmap as to what types of things the new board will likely want to tackle.
Well, very good. We'll all be watching that closely, and we're interested to see how that all works out. Just another programming note, keep a reminder to look out for our emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls. Also, our full schedule of upcoming Teleform calls are on the Federal Society's website, and our podcasts of previous recording calls are there as well. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Ronald Meisberg for joining us today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.